training the mind does not in any way mean forcibly subjugating or brainwashing the mind. To train the mind is first to see directly and concretely how the mind functions, a knowledge that you derive from spiritual teachings and through personal experience in meditation practice. Then you can use that understanding to tame the mind and work with it skillfully to make it more and more pliable so that you can become master of your own mind and employ it to its fullest and most beneficial end. The 8th century Buddhist master Shantideva said, "If this elephant of mind is bound on all sides by the cord of mindfulness, all fear disappears and complete happiness comes. All enemies, all the tigers, lions, elephants, bears, serpents of our emotions, and all the keepers of hell, the demons and the horrors, all of these are bound by the mastery of your mind. And by the taming of that one mind, all are subdued, because from the mind are derived all fears and immeasurable sorrows." The purpose of meditation is to awaken in us the sky-like nature of mind and to introduce us to that which we really are, our unchanging pure awareness, which underlies the whole of life and death. We are fragmented into so many different aspects. We don't know who we really are or what aspects of ourselves we should identify with or believe in. So many contradictory voices, dictates and feelings fight for control over our inner lives that we find ourselves scattered everywhere, in all directions, leaving nobody at home. Meditation, then, is bringing the mind home. In the teaching of Buddha, we say there are three things that make all the difference between your meditation being merely a way of bringing temporary relaxation, peace and bliss, or of becoming a powerful cause for your enlightenment and the enlightenment of others. We call them good in the beginning, good in the middle, and good at the end. Good in the beginning springs from the awareness that we and all sentient beings fundamentally have the Buddha nature as our innermost essence, and that to realize it is to be free of ignorance and to put an end, finally, to suffering. So each time we begin our practice of meditation, we are moved by this and inspire ourselves with the motivation to dedicate our practice and our life to the enlightenment of all beings in the spirit of this prayer, which all the Buddhas of the past have prayed. By the power and the truth of this practice, may all beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all be free from sorrow and the causes of sorrow. May all never be separated from the sacred happiness which is sorrowless. And may all live in equanimity without too much attachment and too much aversion, and live believing in the equality of all that lives. Good in the middle is the frame of mind with which we enter into the heart of the practice, one inspired by the realization of the nature of mind, from which arises an attitude of non-grasping, free of any conceptual reference whatsoever, and an awareness that all things are inherently empty, illusory, and dreamlike. Good at the end is the way in which we bring our meditation to a close, by dedicating all its merit and praying with real fervor. May whatever merit that comes from this practice go toward the enlightenment of all beings. May it become a drop in the ocean of the activity of all the Buddhas in their tireless work for the liberation of all beings. Merit is the positive power and benefit, the peace and happiness that radiate from your practice. You dedicate this merit for the long-term ultimate benefit of beings, for their enlightenment. On a more immediate level, you dedicate it so that there may be peace in the world, so that everyone may be entirely free of want and illness, and experience total well-being and lasting happiness. Then, realizing the illusory and dreamlike nature of reality, you reflect on how, in the deepest sense, you who are dedicating your practice, those to whom you are dedicating it, and even the very act of dedication, are all inherently empty and illusory. This is said in the teachings to seal the meditation and ensure that none of its pure power can leak or seep away, and so ensure that none of the merit of your practice is ever wasted. These three sacred principles, the skillful motivation, the attitude of non-grasping that secures the practice, and the dedication that seals it, are what make your meditation truly enlightening and powerful. They have been beautifully described by the great Tibetan master, Longchenpa, as the heart, the eye, and the life force of true practice. As Nyusho Kempo says, to accomplish complete enlightenment, more than this is not necessary, but less than this is incomplete. Meditation is bringing the mind back home, and this is first achieved through the practice of mindfulness. The practice of mindfulness, of bringing the scattered mind home, and so of bringing the different aspects of our being into focus, is called peacefully remaining, or calm abiding. Peacefully remaining accomplishes three things. First, all the fragmented aspects of ourselves which have been at war settle and dissolve and become friends. In that settling, we begin to understand ourselves more, and sometimes even have glimpses of the radiance of our fundamental nature. Second, the practice of mindfulness diffuses our negativity, aggression, and turbulent emotions, which may have been gathering power over many lifetimes. Rather than suppressing emotions or indulging in them, here it is important to view them and your thoughts and whatever arises with an acceptance and generosity that are as open and spacious as possible. Tibetan masters say that this wise generosity has the flavor of boundless space, so warm and cozy that you feel enveloped and protected by it, as if by a blanket of sunlight. Third, this practice unveils and reveals your essential good heart, because it dissolves and removes the unkindness or the harm in you. Only when we have removed the harm in ourselves do we become truly useful to others. Through the practice, then, by slowly removing the unkindness and harm from ourselves, we allow our true good heart, the fundamental goodness and kindness that are our real nature, to shine out and become the warm climate in which our true being flowers. Meditation is the true practice of peace, the true practice of non-aggression and non-violence, and the real and greatest disarmament.
When I teach meditation, I often begin by saying, bring your mind home, release the grasping, and relax into your nature. The whole point of meditation practice can be essentialized into these three crucial points. That is, bringing your mind home, releasing the grasping, and relaxing in your nature. Each phase contains meaning that resonate on many levels. To bring your mind home means to bring the mind into the state of calm abiding through the practice of mindfulness. In its deepest sense, to bring your mind home is to turn your mind inward and to rest in the nature of mind. This itself is the highest meditation. To release means to release mind from its prison of grasping, since you recognize that all pain and fear and distress rise from the craving of the grasping mind. On a deeper level, the realization and the confidence that rise from your growing understanding of the nature mind inspires the profound and natural generosity that enables you to release all your grasping from your heart and letting it free itself to melt away in the inspiration of meditation. Finally, to relax means to be spacious and to relax the mind of its tensions more deeply. You relax into true nature of your mind, the state of Rigpa. The Tibetan word that evokes the process suggests the sense of relaxing upon the Rigpa. It is like pouring a handful of sand onto a flat surface. Each grain settles of its own accord. This is how you relax into your true nature, letting all thoughts and emotions naturally subside and dissolve into the state of the nature mind. When I meditate, I'm always inspired by the poem by Nyoshi Kempo. Rest in natural great peace, this exhausted mind, beaten helplessly by karma and neurotic thought, like the relentless fury of the pounding waves in the infinite ocean of samsara. Rest in natural great peace. Above all, be at ease, be as natural and spacious as possible. Slip quietly out of the noose of your habitual anxious self. Release all grasping and relax into your true nature. Think of your ordinary emotional thought-ridden self as a block of ice or a slab of butter left out in the sun. If you're feeling hard or cold, let this aggression melt away in the sunlight of your meditation. Let peace work on you and enable you to gather your scattered mind into the mindfulness of calm abiding and awaken in you the awareness of the insight of clear seeing. And you will find that all your negativity disarmed, your aggression dissolved, and your confusion evaporating slowly like the mist into the vast and stainless sky of your absolute nature. Quietly sitting, body still, speech silent, mind at peace, let thoughts and emotions, whatever rises, come and go without clinging to anything. What does the state feel like? The Dhyanamurti used to say, imagine a man who comes home after a long hard day's work in the fields and sinks into his favorite chair in front of the fire. He has been working all day and he knows that he has achieved what he wanted to achieve. There's nothing more to worry about, nothing left accomplished. And he can let go completely of all his cares and concerns, content simply to be. So when you meditate, it is essential to create the right inner environment of the mind. All effort and struggle come from not being spacious. So creating that right environment is vital for your meditation to truly happen. The masters say, if you create an auspicious condition in your body and your environment, then meditation and realization will automatically arise. When humor and spaciousness are present, meditation rises effortlessly. Sometimes when I meditate, I don't use any particular method. I just allow my mind to rest and find, especially when I'm inspired, that I can bring my mind home and relax very quickly. I sit quietly and rest in the nature of mind. I don't question or doubt whether I'm in the correct state or not. There is no effort, only rich understanding, wakefulness, and unshakable certainty. When I am in that nature of mind, the ordinary mind is no longer there. There is no need to sustain or confirm a sense of being. I simply am. A fundamental trust is present. There is nothing in particular to do.
If your mind is able to settle naturally of its own accord, and if you are inspired simply to rest in its pure awareness, then you do not need any method of meditation. In fact, it might even be unskillful when you're in such a state to try to employ one. However, the vast majority of us find it difficult to arrive at that state straight away. We simply do not know how to awaken it, and our minds are so wild and so distracted that we need a skillful means, a method to evoke it. But remember, a method is only a means, not the meditation itself. It is through practicing the method skillfully that you reach the perfection of that pure state of total presence, which is the real meditation. As you continue to practice the method, then meditation slowly arises. Meditation is not something that you can do. It is something that has to happen spontaneously, only when we have perfected the practice. By far the most important feature of meditation is not the technique, but the spirit, the skillful, inspired, and creative way in which we practice, which could also be called the posture. There is a connection between the posture of the body and the attitude of the mind. Mind and body are interrelated, and meditation arises naturally once your posture and attitude are inspired. The posture explained here may differ slightly from others you may be used to. It comes from the ancient teachings of Dzogchen. In the Dzogchen teachings, it is said that your view and your posture should be like a mountain. Your view is the summation of your whole understanding and insight into the nature of mind, which you bring to your meditation. So your view translates into and inspires your posture, expressing the core of your being in the way you sit. Sit then as if you were a mountain, with all the unshakable, steadfast majesty of a mountain. A mountain is completely natural and at ease with itself, however strong the winds that batter it, however thick the dark clouds that swirl around its peak. Sitting like a mountain, let your mind rise and fly and soar. The most essential point of this posture is to keep the back straight, like an arrow or a pile of golden coins. The inner energy, or prana, will then flow easily through the subtle channels of the body, and your mind will find its true state of rest. Don't force anything. The lower part of the spine has a natural curve. It should be relaxed, but upright. Your head should be balanced comfortably on your neck. It is your shoulders and the upper part of your torso that carry the strength and grace of the posture, and they should be held in strong poise, but without any tension. Sit with your legs crossed. You do not have to sit in the full lotus posture, which is emphasized more in advanced yoga practice. The crossed legs express the unity of life and death, good and bad, skillful means and wisdom, masculine and feminine principles, samsara and nirvana, the humor of non-duality. You may also choose to sit on a chair with your legs relaxed, but be sure always to keep your back straight. Your eyes should be kept open. This is a very important point. If you are sensitive to disturbances from outside, when you begin to practice, you may find it helpful to close your eyes for a while and quietly turn within. Once you feel established in calm, gradually open your eyes, and you will find your gaze has grown more peaceful and tranquil. Now look downwards, along the line of your nose, at an angle of about 45 degrees in front of you. One practical tip in general is that whenever your mind is wild, it is best to lower your gaze. And whenever it is dull and sleepy, to bring the gaze up. Once your mind is calm and the clarity of insight begins to arise, you will feel free to bring your gaze up, opening your eyes more and looking into the space directly in front of you. This is the gaze recommended in the Dzogchen practice. In the Dzogchen teachings, it is said that your meditation and your gaze should be like the vast expanse of a great ocean, all-pervading, open, and limitless, just as your view and posture are inseparable. So your meditation inspires your gaze, and they now merge as one. Do not focus then on anything in particular. Instead, turn back into yourself slightly, and let your gaze expand and become more and more spacious and pervasive. You will discover now that your vision itself becomes more expansive, and that there is more peace, more compassion in your gaze, more equanimity, and more poise. There are several reasons for keeping the eyes open. With the eyes open, you're less likely to fall asleep. Then meditation is not a means of running away from the world, or of escaping from it into a trance-like experience of an altered state of consciousness. On the contrary, it is a direct way to help us truly understand ourselves and relate to life and the world. When you meditate, keep your mouth slightly open, as if about to say a deep, relaxing, "Ah." By keeping the mouth slightly open and breathing mainly through the mouth, it is said that the karmic winds that create discursive thoughts are normally less likely to arise and create obstacles in your mind and meditation. Rest your hands comfortably covering your knees. This is called the mind in comfort and ease posture. There is a spark of hope, a playful humor about this posture, which lies in the secret understanding that we all have the Buddha nature. So when you assume this posture, you are playfully imitating a Buddha, acknowledging and giving real encouragement to the emergence of your own Buddha nature. The Buddha taught 84,000 different ways to tame and pacify negative emotions, and in Buddhism there are countless methods of meditation. The following meditation techniques are particularly effective in the modern world. Anyone can use and benefit from them. They are watching the breath, using an object, and reciting a mantra. The first method is very ancient and found in all schools of Buddhism. It is to rest your attention lightly and mindfully on the breath. The breath, or prana in Sanskrit, is said to be the vehicle of the mind, because it is the prana that makes our mind move. So when you calm the mind by working skillfully with the breath, you are simultaneously and automatically taming and training the mind. Haven't we all experienced how relaxing it can be when life becomes stressful to be alone for a few minutes and just breathe in and out? Even such a simple exercise can help us a great... So when you meditate, breathe naturally, just as you always do. Focus your awareness lightly on the out-breath. When you breathe out, just flow out with the out-breath. Each time you breathe out, you are letting go and releasing all your grasping. Imagine your breath dissolving into the all-pervading expanse of truth. Each time you breathe out, and before you breathe in again, you will find that there will be a natural gap as the grasping dissolves. Rest in that gap, in that open space. And when naturally you breathe in, don't focus especially on the in-breath, but go on resting your mind in the gap that has opened up. When you are practicing, it's important not to get involved in mental commentary, analysis, or internal gossip. Do not mistake the running commentary in your mind. Now I'm breathing in, now I'm breathing out, for mindfulness. What is important is pure presence. Don't concentrate too much on the breath. Give it about 25% of your attention, with the other 75% quietly and spaciously relaxed. As you become more mindful of your breathing, you will find that you become more and more present. Gather all your scattered aspects back into yourself and become whole. Rather than watching the breath, let yourself gradually identify with it, as if you were becoming it. Slowly the breath, the breather, and the breathing become one. Duality and separation dissolve. You will find that this very simple process of mindfulness filters your thoughts and emotions. Then, as if you were shedding an old skin, something is peeled off and freed. Some people, however, are not relaxed or at ease with watching the breathing. They find it almost claustrophobic. For them, the next technique might be more helpful. A second method, which many people find useful, is to rest the mind lightly on an object. You can use an object of natural beauty that invokes a special feeling of inspiration for you, such as a flower or crystal. But something that embodies the truth, such as an image of the Buddha or Christ, or particularly your master, is even more powerful. Your master is your living link with the truth, and because of your personal connection to your master, just seeing his or her face connects you to the inspiration and truth of your own nature. Lightly set your attention on the object, then leave your mind quietly at peace. A third technique, used a great deal in Tibetan Buddhism and also in Sufism, Orthodox Christianity, and Hinduism, is uniting the mind with the sound of a mantra. The definition of mantra is that which protects the mind. That which protects the mind from negativity, or that which protects you from your own mind, is called mantra. When you are nervous, disoriented, or emotionally fragile, chanting or reciting a mantra inspiringly can change the state of your mind completely by transforming its energy and atmosphere. How is this possible? Mantra is the essence of sound and the embodiment of the truth in the form of sound. Each syllable is impregnated with spiritual power, condenses a spiritual truth, and vibrates with the blessing of the speech of the Buddhas. It is also said that the mind rides on the subtle energy of the breath, the prana, which moves through and purifies the subtle channels of the body. So when you chant a mantra, you are charging your breath and energy with the energy of the mantra, and so working directly on your mind and subtle body. The mantra Sogyal Rinpoche recommends to his students is Om Ahung Benza Guru Pebma Siddhi Hung, which is the mantra of Padmasambhava, the mantra of all the Buddhas, masters, and realized beings, and so uniquely powerful for peace, for healing, for transformation, and for protection in this violent, chaotic age. Recite the mantra quietly, with deep attention, and let your breath, the mantra, and your awareness become slowly one. Or chant it in an inspiring way, and rest in the profound silence that sometimes follows. What, then, should we do with the mind in meditation? Nothing at all. Just leave it, simply, as it is. One master described meditation as mind suspended in space, nowhere. There is a famous saying, if the mind is not contrived, it is spontaneously blissful. Just as water, when not agitated, is by nature transparent and clear. The mind in meditation could be compared to a jar of muddy water. The more we leave the water without interfering or stirring it, the more the particles of dirt will sink to the bottom, letting the natural clarity of the water shine through. The very nature of the mind is such that if you only leave it in its unaltered and natural state, it will find its true nature, which is bliss and clarity. So take care not to impose anything on the mind or to tax it. When you meditate, there should be no effort to control and no attempt to be peaceful. Don't be overly solemn or feel that you are taking part in some special ritual. Let go even of the idea that you are meditating. Let your body remain as it is and your breath as you find it. Think of yourself as the sky holding the whole universe. In meditation, as in all arts, there has to be a delicate balance between relaxation and alertness. One of the greatest of Tibet's many woman masters, Machig Labdon, said, "Alert, alert, yet relax, relax." This is a crucial point for the view in meditation. Alert your alertness. But at the same time, be relaxed, so relaxed, in fact, that you don't even hold on to an idea of relaxation.
When people begin to meditate, they often say that their thoughts are running riot and have become wilder than ever before. This is a good sign. Far from meaning that your thoughts have become wilder, it shows that you have become quieter. And you are finally aware of just how noisy your thoughts have always been. Don't be disheartened or give up. Whatever arises, just keep being present. Keep returning to the breath, even in the midst of all the confusion. Sometimes people think that when they meditate, there should be no thoughts and emotions at all. And when thoughts and emotions do arise, they become annoyed and exasperated with themselves and think they have failed. Nothing could be further from the truth. There is a Tibetan saying, "It's a tall order to ask for meat without bones and tea without leaves." So long as you have a mind, there will be thoughts and emotions. Thoughts and emotions are the radiance and expression of the very nature of the mind. They arise from the mind, but where do they dissolve? Back into the mind. Whatever rises, do not see it as a particular problem. If you do not impulsively react, if you are only patient, it will once again settle into its essential nature. When you have this understanding, then rising thoughts only enhance your practice. But when you do not understand what they intrinsically are, the radiance of the nature of your mind, then your thoughts become the seed of confusion. So have a spacious, open, and compassionate attitude toward your thoughts and emotions. Because in fact, your thoughts are your family, the family of your mind. Before them, as Dujom Rinpoche used to say, be like an old wise man watching a child play. So whatever thoughts and emotions arise, allow them to rise and settle like the waves in the ocean. Whatever you find yourself thinking, let that thought rise and settle without any constraint. Don't grasp at it, feed it, or indulge it. Don't cling to it, and don't try to solidify it. Neither follow thoughts nor invite them. Be like the ocean looking at its own waves, or the sky gazing down on the clouds that pass through it. You will soon find that thoughts are like the wind. They come and go. The secret is not to think about thoughts, but to allow them to flow through the mind while keeping your mind free of afterthoughts. As you continue to practice, you may have all kinds of experiences, both good and bad. You might experience states of bliss, clarity, or absence of thoughts. By themselves, they are good experiences, but if you get attached to them, they become obstacles. Experiences are not realization in themselves, but if we remain free of attachment to them, they become what they really are, that is, materials for realization. Negative experiences are often the most misleading, because we usually take them as a bad sign. But in fact, the negative experiences in our practice are blessings in disguise. Try not to react to them with aversion as you might normally do, but recognize them instead for what they truly are, merely experiences, illusory and dreamlike. The realization of the true nature of the experience liberates you from the harm or danger of the experience itself, and as a result, even a negative experience can become a source of great blessing and accomplishment. Traditionally, it's said that for a real practitioner, it's not the negative experiences but the good ones that bring obstacles. When things are going well, you have got to be especially careful and mindful so that you don't become complacent or overconfident. What we have to learn in both meditation and in life is to be free of attachment to the good experiences and free of aversion to the negative ones. Dujom Rinpoche warns us of another pitfall. On the other hand, in meditation practice, you might experience a muddy, semi-conscious, drifting state, like having a hood over your head, a dreamy dullness. This is really nothing more than a kind of blurred and mindless stagnation. How do you get out of this state? Alert yourself. Straighten your back. Breathe the stale air out of your lungs and direct your awareness into clear space to freshen your mind. If you remain in this stagnant state, you will not evolve. So whenever this setback arises, clear it again and again. It is important to be as watchful as possible and to stay as vigilant as you can. Whatever method you use, drop it or simply let it dissolve on its own when you find you have arrived naturally at a state of alert, expansive, and vibrant peace. Then continue to remain there quietly, undistracted, without necessarily using any particular method. The method has already achieved its purpose. However, if you do stray or become distracted, then return to whatever technique is most appropriate to call you back. Dujom Rinpoche used to say that a beginner should practice in short sessions. Practice for 4 or 5 minutes, and then take a short break for just 1 minute. But be mindful of whatever you do, and do not lose your presence and its natural ease. Then alert yourself and sit again. If you do many short sessions like this, your breaks will often make your meditation more real and more inspiring. They will take the clumsy, irksome rigidity and solemnity and unnaturalness out of your practice and bring you more and more focus and ease. Gradually, through this interplay of breaks and sitting, the barrier between meditation and everyday life will crumble. The contrast between them will dissolve, and you will find yourself in... Then, as Dudjom Rinpoche used to say, even though the meditation will not leave the meditator. To integrate meditation in action is the whole ground and point and purpose of integration. How then do we achieve this integration? This permeation of everyday life with the calm humor and spacious detachment of meditation. There is no substitute for regular practice. For only through real practice will we begin to taste unbrokenly the calm of our nature of mind, and so be able to sustain the experience of it in our everyday life. Be mindful not to come out of meditation too quickly. Allow a period of some minutes for the peace of the practice of meditation to infiltrate your life. Dudjom Rinpoche said, "Don't jump up and rush off, but mingle your mindfulness with everyday life. Be like a man who's fractured his skull, always careful in case someone will touch him." Then, after meditation, it's important not to give in to the tendency we have to solidify the way we perceive things. When you do re-enter everyday life, let the wisdom, insight, compassion, humor, fluidity, spaciousness, and detachment that meditation brought you pervade your day-to-day experience. Meditation awakens in you the realization of how the nature of everything is illusory and dreamlike. Maintain that awareness, even in the thick of samsara. And if you really wish to achieve this, what you need to do is not just practice as an occasional medicine or therapy, but as if it were your daily sustenance or food. This is why one excellent way to develop this power of integration is to practice it in a retreat environment, far from stresses of modern city life. All too often, people come to meditation in the hope of extraordinary results, like visions, lights, or some supernatural miracle. When no such thing occurs, they feel extremely disappointed. But the real miracle of meditation is more ordinary and much more useful. It is a subtle transformation. And this transformation happens not only in your mind and your emotions, but also actually in your body. It is very healing. The whole state of your health has a lot to do with your state of mind and your way of being. If you find that meditation does not come easily in your city room, be inventive and go out into nature. Nature is always an unfailing fountain of inspiration. To calm your mind, go for a walk at dawn in the park, or watch the dew on a rose in a garden. Lie on the ground and gaze up into the sky, and let your mind expand into its spaciousness. Let the sky outside awake a sky inside your mind. Stand by a stream and mingle your mind with its rushing. Become one with its ceaseless sound. Sit by a waterfall and let its healing laughter purify your spirit. Walk on a beach and take the sea wind full and sweet against your face. Celebrate and use the beauty of moonlight to poise your mind. Sit by a lake or in a garden and breathing quietly, let your mind fall silent as the moon comes up, majestically and slowly in the cloudless night.
Since the dawn of history, reincarnation and a firm faith in life after death have occupied an essential place in nearly all the world's religions. Since the advent of interest in Eastern religions that began at the end of the last century, a remarkable number of Westerners have come to accept the Hindu and Buddhist knowledge of rebirth. However, most people have still only the most shadowy idea about life after death and no idea of what it might be like. Again and again, people say they cannot bring themselves to believe in something for which there is no evidence. But that is hardly any proof, is it, that it does not exist? As Voltaire said, after all, it is no more surprising to be born twice than it is to be born once. Why do all the major religions believe in a life after this one? And why have hundreds of millions of people throughout history, including the great philosophers, sages, and creative geniuses of Asia, live this belief as an essential part of their lives? Were they all simply deluded? Those of us who undertake a spiritual discipline, of meditation, for example, come to discover many things about our own mind that we did not know before. For as our mind opens more and more to the extraordinary, vast, and hitherto unsuspected existence of the nature of mind, we begin to glimpse a completely different dimension, one in which all of our assumptions about our identity and reality, which we thought we knew so well, start to dissolve, and in which the possibility of lives other than this one becomes at least likely. We begin to understand that everything that we are being told by the masters about life and death and life after death is real. From the Buddhist point of view, the main argument that establishes rebirth is one based on a profound understanding of the continuity of mind. Where does consciousness come from? It cannot arise out of nowhere. A moment of consciousness cannot arise without the moment of consciousness that immediately preceded it. The basis on which Buddhists accept the concept of rebirth is principally the continuity of consciousness. Most people take the word reincarnation to imply there is some thing that reincarnates, which travels from life to life. But in Buddhism, we do not believe in an independent and unchanging entity like a soul or ego that survives the death of the body. What provides the continuity between lives is not an entity, we believe, but the ultimately subtlest level of consciousness. The exact way in which rebirth takes place has been well illustrated with the following example. The successive existences in a series of rebirths are not like the pearls in a pearl necklace held together by a string, the soul which passes through all the pearls. Rather, they are like dice piled one on top of the other. Each die is separate, but it supports the one above it, with which it is functionally connected. Between the dice, there is no identity, but conditionality.